It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in the San Francisco Bay Area. Patrick Brennan is the founder and portfolio manager of Brennan Asset Management, a registered investment advisory firm based in Napa, California. BAM utilizes a concentrated value investing strategy. It manages separate accounts and is the sub-advisor for the Ocean Cross Capital Partners Fund. Prior to founding the firm, Patrick managed portfolios and led research efforts at two value investing firms in California, Hutchinson Capital Management and RBO & Company. Previously, he worked at Mark Boyar & Company, where he led the firm's research team and helped manage $800 million of assets across individual portfolios, institutional accounts, and a mutual fund. Patrick also worked for 6 years in investment banking and equity research with Deutsche Bank, CIBC World Markets, and William Blair & Company. He graduated summa cum laude from the University of Notre Dame with a degree in economics and was inducted into Phi Beta Kappa. Patrick received the CFA designation in 2002 and is a member of the CFA Institute. He is originally from Omaha, Nebraska. On behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a warm welcome to you, Patrick. Please go ahead.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for the introduction, and it's a pleasure to present for to the Manual of Ideas audience again. So I'll get started. Just real brief background. You heard the introduction. Just sort of add generally. We focus on just a couple of industries and a couple areas that we think have, empirical evidence showing that they outperform. And within those industry groups outside of media, telecom, the financial service space is an area we spend a lot of time on, and that's the sector that we're going to be talking about today. And sort of a quick backdrop, I think this is familiar to a lot of people, but the last certainly last 3 months, we've been in sort of full blown risk off mode. A lot of names that were, statistically cheap, probably heading into the sell off at the end of the year. Maybe they held up fairly well for a little bit, but then cheap got a lot cheaper and, it was sort of everything was thrown out. And so, interestingly, if you think about risk off names sold, what screens particularly well for what investors do not like right now would be financials, levered names, something with exposure to slowing growth and low interest rates, anything with a hint of exposure to Europe and complicated stories. And so I think we're going to present two names that successfully between the two of them, check off all those boxes. And, so obviously there's, a lot of bad news priced in, even, in some cases where there is, a pretty strong story going on. And we think a lot of the, at current levels, you just don't need much to go right to do well. And so we think it's kind of the proverbial heads I win potentially a lot, tails I don't lose much. So with that introduction, we're going to start with Jefferies. This one, and it'll be when I talk Jefferies, it is think the historical Leucadia, which I think most value investors are pretty familiar with. And the name was changed from Leucadia to Jefferies, and then the investment bank is named Jefferies as well. So Jefferies Financial Group is the new holding company name. So, one added point of confusion. So I'll just talk about the investment bank when I'm talking about, Jefferies as a whole, when I'm talking about the investment bank. So this is just kind of a quick background. I'm happy to go through all of the subsidiaries, if someone spends time on this and they want to talk through some of the assumptions, but really, you can sort of see as a percentage of the total net asset value, you got to get comfortable with the investment bank because, that's sort of half the value. But, there's a lot beneath the surface. And, later in the presentation, we will talk on, some of the other parts of the bank. So taking a step back, the so Jefferies was standalone investment bank. Leucadia with Ian Cumming and Joe Steinberg, you know, value investing legends, you know, compounded value for years. They had an equity investment and longstanding relationship with Jefferies and its CEO, Rich Handler. And they didn't have a clear succession plan, made a deal to acquire Jefferies at the end of 2012, closes in 2013. And it's been a deeply unpopular stock since then. And, you know, one thing I don't think that is as well appreciated is just how strong the track record was at Jefferies. People know about Joe and Ian, but I think probably less well known is what Rich did while he was at Jefferies. So here's the growth in book value. Maybe more interestingly, this is the shareholder returns from 19, you know, very long shareholder returns up until when the merger was announced, the last period before the merger was announced. And I think focusing on the second half there from 2000 to 2013, because that's when Rich Handler was CEO of Jefferies. And you think about everything that happened from 2000 to 2013, that was, you know, two very full economic cycles and two big downturns for, especially in the financial services space during the dot-com blow up in 2000, 2001, and then certainly the great financial crisis. And you can see the returns that the Jefferies generated. But, you know, again, shareholders want nothing to do with this company. And so we're going to dig in and see how well justified that is. So I think a lot of people are familiar with the narrative of, you know, the investment banking. It had probably been a little bit of a tougher business since the financial crisis. And I think the perception is, you know, look, banks were levered up 30-1. They took huge risks, and then the financial crisis happened. It blew them up, and the model is permanently impaired. And, you know, there's, of course, with any like narrative, there's parts that are true and the parts that, you know, don't hold up to scrutiny. Certainly the, you know, what you can see from this chart is that, you know, the business has expanded quite a bit. I mean, the revenues have more than doubled from 2006 to the, you know, last full fiscal year ending in 2017. But there is more capital against the business, so it clearly is not as profitable. But I think it's important to note that when Jefferies was really humming, you know, pre-financial crisis, they were not levered. You know, this was not Lehman Brothers. In sort of a quick summary, you know, 11, 12 times leverage, very responsible. It's even lower now. And so its return on equity, return on tangible equity, is not as strong as it was. But, you know, you look at the bottom valuation and you sort of say, okay, maybe it's not worth 2 to 3 times book anymore. But is, you know, 70% of tangible book really a reasonable number for this business? And the other thing to keep in mind, what's different here is it's is obviously you saw all those subsidiaries on the previous page. Profits from the investment bank do not just have to go back to the investment bank. They can be recycled into other investments. And, you know, we would, you know, as we'll argue later on, we think Rich is a pretty good capital allocator. And ultimately, we think that'll be reflected. So I won't spend a lot of time on this chart, but it just sort of shows a similar message to the last one across the industries. Revenues have rebounded for the American banks. The European banks have had to pull back, and you can see from, you know, the revenue increase from Jefferies, they took a lot of share. If we were to plot this against the equity of the businesses, all of these businesses have a lot more equity against the revenue base, so they're not as profitable from that point of view. So business has recovered, but, you know, not as profitable across the entire industry. So here is the historical investment bank performance from Jefferies Investment Bank, and a lot of numbers to focus, you know, on here. I'm not going to go through everything in detail. I think what I just the high level point I'd like to get across is that since the merger closed in 2013, the investment bank has had some inconsistent results. Now, the more recent period has been a lot stronger. You know, the last 7 quarters, you know, roughly a 10% average return on tangible equity. And I should point out, you know, so some would say, well, you know, why are you using tangible equity? Why not full equity at the bank? Well, keep in mind that the goodwill that was created was, it was solely based upon the Leucadia shares were exchanged for Jefferies shares. There was a 20% premium paid. The goodwill is simply a function of what the stock price of Leucadia was when they issued shares for Jefferies. And so keep that in mind, you know, when we're talking about return on tangible equity going forward. But, you know, clearly there was a commodities future business that Jefferies had purchased. They thought they got a good deal purchasing at book value. The business produced losses in 2014 and 15. It was shut down and sold, but that negatively impacted results. And so maybe the last couple quarters, last couple years have been more reflection of what the, you know, the run rate of the business is. And I think, again, you know, the point that I'll make a couple times is that if you sort of think about like the money from Jefferies being, you know, going forward, 50% of this is dividend back to the holding company to invest in whatever, invest in stock repurchases, invest in other deals. You know, this is not quite as good as float from, you know, a property and casualty company below, you know, 100% combined ratio. But it's a better income generator, I think, than, you know, anything that Joe and Ian had to work with over time. And those two, they did a fabulous job, but they, you know, were kind of forced to pull a rabbit out of their hat on a regular basis. So I think, you know, the next couple slides I'll go through, you know, fairly quickly. It's under the category, again, of, hey, black box investment bank. What do they own? We already mentioned their leverage in the past. They've always behaved responsibly here. They continue to behave responsibly. This is not that out of whack with a normal, commercial bank. And I would also point out that, you know, at roughly $40 billion of total assets, they are not subject to Jefferies Investment Bank is not, you know, subject to the, you know, significantly important financial institution rules, Dodd-Frank, et cetera. So they have a lot more leeway in the products that they can pursue. And obviously, the entire holding company can make investments in merchant banking businesses that would be harder for the largest investment banks to do under the post-financial crisis rules. So here, this is just, you know, again, and it's not so much, again, you or say, okay, I'm comfortable with the leverage, but again, you know, what? Who knows what's on the balance sheet of an investment bank? And, you know, one, you kind of quantitative way to measure this is just to sort of say, hey, level three assets, you know, the quote unquote mark to model assets are a very small percentage of the total asset base of the investment bank. And they're a very reasonable percentage of the total tangible equity base. And so they were never a big player in the, you know, the famous CDO, CDO squares, you know, various non-exchange derivative products. And I think that's important. Now, that's not to say that, you know, they are active in leveraged loans. They're, you know, an active issuer of high yield bonds in a given quarter. You know, could they have a hung deal that, you know, they have to take a write down on? Absolutely. But I think the bigger fear is sort of some of these more esoteric products. And again, they have a lot less exposure than other banks. And maybe at the, you know, just more basic level, you know, the insiders, they own a lot of stock. And, you know, so maybe this, you can think about this as the old school Wall Street partnership where it's the partners own money at stake and you behave a little differently. And Rich Handler, you know, we saw the huge rise in Jefferies stock over the last, 20 some years, and you know, outside of charities and taxes, never sold a share. And I think that's impressive. He's, you know, one of the 10 largest shareholders. And I think your sort of entire risk management framework, you know, changes when you're a significant equity owner. You know, we saw the big revenue increase since 2006. They've bought teams, they've introduced products, they've actually had another wave of investments since 2017. You know, I'm not going to spend a time on each individual part of this. You know, the big, you know, takeaway message is if you bring over a team of industry bankers, then you have to, you know, they usually have restricted stock at the previous employer. You have an upfront compensation cost for them. And then it's a question of, you know, how long does it take for them to produce revenues? And there's a lag. And so as you expand, it's going to be negative to the P&L initially, and it takes time for this wave of investments to, you know, to show through. And I think some of the, you know, prior investments in, you know, immediately post the crisis were beginning to show up, you know, in the last couple of years. And I think this, you know, new wave of hiring can also begin to bear fruit over the next couple of years. So, you know, this is just, I'll put this out there for just, this is just sort of, for any of you, you know, you probably have worked at investment banks, you're familiar with all these league tables. The point on this is just simply that European banks have pulled back you know, the Jefferies has moved up the tables, and you look down this, you know, list, and you sort of say, is there going to be a point in time in the future where maybe a bank in Asia wants to enter, you know, quote unquote, tier one investment banking in the United States? And if you look at the all the names here, there really aren't that many available. So there is something of a scarcity value for, you know, a non-bank global investment bank that Jefferies is right now. So, you know, we sort of, the narrative was we, you know, so we had this good long-term track record. We closed the deal. Investors, you know, don't like, owning a New York investment bank. Jefferies has some struggles with, you know, the Prubache write-downs, early on. We'll talk about National Beef, in a second. But you had this sort of narrative that, you know, the shareholders aren't supporting this. There's little, you know, Wall Street coverage. It's conglomerate. And then, you know, the stock has not responded. I think as well as both, you know, Rich Handler and Brian Friedman at Hope. And in April of last year, they announced, you know, several investments monetizing, a good portion of their largest merchant banking asset, National Beef, for an enormous gain, selling part of, you know, the car dealership business Garcadia for a long-term or, you know, long-time Leucadia followers recognize that name. Garcadia comes in, and Leucadia Investment Management with Jefferies, an energy investment, does a follow-on. They switch their fiscal year for the merchant bank and investment bank to November 30th. That may not sound like much, but they, you know, they had a lot of blackout days where they were restricted from buying stocks. And then, you know, they upped the buyback program considerably. And so if you were going to wage an activist campaign and sort of say, geez, simplify this, buy back stock, they sort of did that on their own. And the stock, you know, it responds immediately, but then, you know, falls back. And then, you know, again, sort of look and see how justified this, you know, this is. I'm not going to go into Berkadia in great detail. The reason I just brought it up is from the previous slide, this is now part of the investment bank Jefferies. And as you can see, they own half this, the other half's owned by Berkshire Hathaway. It's a commercial loans originator and servicer. The loans that originate are generally sold to the government agencies. They have top market share. It's a very predictable and a stable business. And so what happened is clearly their 50% share in this was worth a good amount of money, but as part of a conglomerate, it's just unclear investors were ascribing any value to this. And so by moving it into the investment bank, you're going to add, you know, you can sort of see here, you know, give or take $200 million of pre-tax income. You know, they keep half of that. So it's $100 million added to, you know, and, you know, variation, but say it's $400 to $500 million pre-tax of Jefferies. And so this is a sizable shot in the arm, and it also will be sort of a stabilizing in, you know, impact for the, you know, the other aspects of the investment bank are a little more volatile. This chart just simply shows the principal balance of outstanding commercial loans that Berkadia works with. Big opportunity over the coming years to continue to take share. Leucadia Asset Management, they've decided rather than to go buy an asset manager, they're going to start one from scratch. It's got $17 billion of AUM. It's not material to the overall value of both Jefferies Investment Bank and Jefferies, the entire merchant bank, but it's optionality. This can grow over time. This type of investment would be, I just pointed out, it would be one that would be a little more difficult for some of the larger banks to fund on their own, to both, you know, fund strategies to take stakes in the general partnership, you know, of these businesses. And they think sort of slow and steady wins this bank, wins the race. And again, then over time, you can have a, you know, decent little fee stream, you know, from this business. So before we talk about just a couple of the, you know, larger aspects of the merchant bank, I just want to address, you know, I think that one of the big issues with Jefferies, the investment bank, is sort of the, you know, I call it the Goldman issue. It's just, when people start looking at this as a possible name, and you have a period where Goldman Sachs sells off, you know, you just sort of naturally ask, well, you know, why do I want to mess around with Jefferies if I can own Goldman Sachs below tangible book value? And I'm not going to argue Goldman below tangible book is not very interesting. And, you know, they have generated more consistent, you know, returns over time. But, you know, I think maybe what's less well appreciated is the, you know, you saw the historical ratios for what Jefferies was valued at pre-financial crisis. And historically, the smaller investment banks had traded at larger premiums to, you know, the largest banks that were sort of an amalgamation of, you know, multiple different businesses. But interestingly, it's the smaller advisory-only businesses that have traded at, you know, large premiums to, you know, to book value. And I think one of the great points that came out of the October Analyst Day last year was just, you know, if you think about Jefferies, you know, they have quite an M&A advisory franchise themselves, similar margins with some of the banks you see at the bottom. And so if you wanted to sort of go through and do a sum of the parts, you know, analysis of you know, say, hey, their M&A franchise alone's worth 2x value, what's the trading business worth, et cetera, it, you know, I just find it harder to believe that you're going to get a value consistently below, you know, at least tangible book value for a period of time. And I do think that there will be a, you know, a premium ascribed to it, assuming, you know, results continue to be steady, and or there's, you know, potentially the opportunity for somebody else to come in and take a minority stake in the investment bank. So that's the largest aspect of the investment. You know, clearly half the value is not in Jefferies standalone investment bank. And I'm not going to go through every subsidiary. I just wanted to highlight two large ones real quick, and I'd be happy to follow up with any specific questions on some of these others, which, you know, are significant. I think they can drive really interesting returns over time. But these businesses, I would also point out, they're a combination of, you know, sort of legacy Leucadia investments, Joe and Ian investments, if you will, that were held on to, you know, or disposed of at favorable prices, and new investments that have been made since the merger closed. So starting with National Beef, one of the problems with you know, the entire stock since the merger closed was, you know, we discussed some of the issues that the investment bank had had. At the same time that happened, a historical National Beef, which is a very steady business, fourth largest beef processor in the United States, had sort of a 100-year storm where it was a caused in part by, you know, a drought that really ravaged you know, ranchers, and you had a big spike in commodity prices. It was very expensive to maintain herd levels, and so those were depleted to historically low levels, and so the ones that came for slaughter were more expensive, and that's the COGS for a processing business. And this was a huge part of the combined company at merger closing, and the business that had been generating a couple $100 million went negative, and it happened at the same time that Jefferies was struggling. So when their stock price was weak in 2015, it happened at a time that by far their two largest businesses were struggling, and you can see the rebound. It's not just in herd levels, but, you know, there's very little tangible capital in this business. In fact, it was negative for several quarters of the past year, and you generated over $600 million of EBITDA, and you have fantastic visibility just because it's very expensive to build a new processor. Nobody wants it, you know, the smell, you know, a view that it doesn't generate enough high-paying jobs. And so you have a lot of visibility on future supply. It's not coming in. But at the same time, you know, the business can have a downturn. And, you know, this is the point in the cycle that you sold it. They sold, a high 40s percentage portion of the business. They have 30% left. It's probably going to continue to produce very strong profits for the next couple of years. And this will be a nice steady dividend stream that comes in, but they monetize this and made it a more reasonable percentage of the total business. Linkem, this is another historical business, historical Joeian investment, that a follow-on investment was made with Rich Brian. And this is wireless broadband. And, you know, from prior presentations, you know, if you're familiar with European broadband in Italy, it's very, very difficult. Hilly country. I think by United Nations surveys, Italy ranks near the bottom of developed countries in terms of, total broadband access. And so this is using, for cable investors, it's using a mid-band spectrum technology. And it happens at the same time that, 5G is on the horizon. And this spectrum is very valuable. You can see the two lines with the quarterly subscribers have gone up in a nice stair-step function, but the spectrum alone, according to the last auction, would be at a pretty good premium to the last mark on the business. And so this one I'd sort of highlight as one that it's very possible there could be an IPO of this business, and this could be a big big return for the company. So this is from the investment day in October, and interestingly, one of the, in the efforts of better disclosure, they announced that in addition to the November 30th fiscal year end, they're going to mark all of their merchant banking assets twice a year. And, again, we can spend time later on debating any of the valuations on one of these businesses, but I think it at least it forces people to say, well, what is this stuff worth? And most of these businesses are pretty reasonable. So it's just sort of said, the fair value of Linkem was sort of, just under $500 million when we're saying they're, a little over 54% diluted stake. The entire business, the entire spectrum, forget about the business, is probably worth, $750 million-ish dollars. So, you add this up and you sort of say, well, it's probably, all of these various businesses, against the stock price, the, $17, $18 a share. If we take the base value of all of these and we sort of say, okay, you have 15% premium for the investment bank, and I'll take, marks down. You can sort of see here on the, on the investments, it's not hard to get sort of a 30-ish dollar value. And, on the bear side, you haircut everything and you say the bank's impaired and, it's not even worth, it's worth 75% of book going forward. I'm not sure what exactly that implies, sub 10%, returns indefinitely. It's really hard to get down to sort of 18 bucks. And so it's just, there's upside to, what we have if there, if you take a pessimistic view. I think a more realistic view, there's very solid upside. And then obviously, you look at this and share repurchases are highly accretive. And that takes us right to the, to the next page. It's sort of like, well, what changes? This has been statistically cheap. Okay, Jeffrey's a little better, balance sheet better, you did a nice job on some of these investments, and the stock still trades down here. And, look, this is part of investing in these type of names, is you just have these big swings and, sentiment, and if the market sells off, these things sell off. And I think a big change is, they took out 7% of the shares in the first 9 months. In October, Rich was probably as vocal as he's ever been about the stock was very, very cheap at $24 a share. And he said, like, look, we're not going to hype it, but we're going to keep buying. And I think that's just the real answer. I think there was a unique period in time in 2015. National Beef was struggling when Jeffries was struggling. Merger had just been completed, that they weren't in a position to do maybe as aggressive share repurchases as they like. And so the stock's almost back to where it was back then, and a much stronger franchise and a much stronger willingness to purchase a lot of shares. And I just think the combination of taking out stock at a material discount to tangible book value, at a huge discount to likely fair market value, combined with a couple more wins on the merchant banking monetizations, I think there could just be a light bulb that goes off saying, I trust these guys. I think they're pretty good. And there's just a comfort that comes with, okay, yes, there's a lot going on, but you know, I think book value per share is going to grow over time. I enjoy investing alongside these folks who have big skin in the game. And so, you know, the key risks here, I think there is a real key person risk if, you know, something were happened to, you know, the top two guys. You know, obviously inconsistencies are at Jefferies, they could do a bad deal. And, you know, obviously there is the risk of, you know, sort of, hey, dead money. It's just people aren't going to pay up. They're not going to ascribe a higher value. They're going to permanently ascribe a discount for Jefferies. And, you know, that is possible, hopefully mitigated by taking out a lot of shares. So, but a little bit of a mouthful. The next, you know, moving right over to the next one. If there's anything that you say, well, geez, what could be worse than a U.S. investment bank? You know, to find something more unpopular. Unfortunately, I own a couple of things that I think could give it a run. And one that is certainly, if you start talking about financials in Europe, I mean, you're just talking about like a, you know, it feels like a graveyard of problems and the well-known macro problems. You know, Brexit, you name it. Interest rates, they feel like they are never going to rise in our lifetime. It's sort of, it's a somewhat similar feeling. You know, for, you know, in the U.S. in 2010, 11, you just looked like you were going, you know, staring into the abyss. And it just sort of felt like they may not rise for another 10 years. That's where we are. You can sort of see where book value, 60% of book for, you know, a large, you know, cross mix of European assets. And, you know, so you have this. And then so kind of moving to, you know, that's the backdrop for European financials. We're going to be talking about Ireland, and I think many are probably familiar. They had a spectacular housing boom and then bust. You know, where housing prices are down sort of 60%. Government had to guarantee all the liabilities of the on the banking side, including sub debt. It was an extraordinary action. They had to nationalize many of the banks, and including the one we're going to be talking about today. And so this was a really traumatic experience for Ireland. But what's interesting is that it has really rebounded. And in face of all the gloom we talked about in Europe that you read about, Ireland's economy is really on fire. And it may be this part, this story, a little less well known, but, you know, you sort of see a bunch of economic numbers. The one at the top of the page is probably the one that matters. You know, you're talking 3-4% projected growth coming off even faster levels the last couple of years. And at the same time that that's happening, there's been a real resurgence in the housing market. The combination of this big economic expansion, migration into Ireland, and partially as a result of Brexit, you know, we'll talk about here in a second, and just the, you know, pent up demand post the financial crisis in Ireland has really caused housing prices to boom. They're below the absolute peak levels still, but they're, you know, you sort of see here about 108% of 2005 levels. And this part, I think, of the Ireland story is probably even less well known. And so this is just sort of the household formation, talking about people moving into Ireland, you know, second homes, replacement costs. You throw this all into the blender, and they need a little over 30,000 units annually to keep up with demand. And they're roughly at half the levels that right now. Certainly, there is projects that are being developed that are being built right now. But this could take well into the next decade to fully remedy the supply-demand imbalance. And, you know, interestingly, another company we own, Kennedy Wilson, is the largest commercial landlord in downtown Dublin, had spoken about this, you know, housing demand-supply imbalance. And it's very much true on the residential side. And you know, one quick note on Brexit, because that is something that, you know, it's an unpredictable outcome. But Ireland, generally speaking, has benefited to a certain degree because a lot of the businesses that are considering moving, families that are considering moving, you know, a English speaking country right next door, it's a very popular destination. And without a doubt, it's had a big impact on commercial prices and residential prices in Ireland. So naturally, you know, you go through all this and say somebody has to finance all of this, and that is going to be the banks. And interestingly enough, when you look at sort of the cost of mortgages in Ireland, you know, they're a lot higher than the rest of the euro average. And why is that? And we'll touch on a couple of the reasons, but you know, really, you have a very concentrated banking system. You have historically the banks have a large number of tracking mortgages, and you know, these are mortgages that are essentially tied to ECB rates that are negative, so very low yielding rates, and there's a lot of capital that has to be held against those businesses. So it's and then you also have a very messy foreclosure process. So you have this, you know, kind of weird mix of very strong economy, huge demand for housing, but then very, very restrictive financial capital rules against Irish banking assets. So all that is a backdrop, and sort of as we studied this, we sort of came across Permanent TSB, and so this it's a smaller bank, and it's so this one, it's 75% government owned. They did a IPO in 2015. Stock has declined 60% since that time. I mean, this is just a bombed out name. You know, when you're talking, you know, below 40%, you know, if we could get back up to the, you know, where the, you know, the rest of the bombed out Europe financial names are trading, we can do pretty well on this name. And it has a respectable presence in the mortgage market that I spent some time describing. And the two largest banks in Ireland, Bank of Ireland and Allied Irish Bank, AIB, are by far the two largest, control a huge portion of the overall mortgage market. And there's a void of a third challenger to those two. And I'll sort of address that in the future, and that could be an opportunity for a possible transaction. But at this level, there's a lot of ways to win. And, you know, obviously just, you know, as I said, there's a void of a number three. There's reason to think that there is a possible merger possibility between Permanent and another bank. Obviously, if interest rates were to rise, much like in the United States, you saw the, you know, sort of the turbocharge in financial service names in the U.S. when rates started rising. It feels like that's going to be forever ago. But if rates rise a little bit, I mean, the entire sector in Europe probably goes up. But and Permanent TSB is highly, highly sensitive to that. But I think the part that's why it's most interesting, in addition to, you know, potentially being a sale candidate, is the capital return. There is a self-help story that if everything else goes wrong, they can return a lot of capital. And so again, you're in this combination of, you know, heads I win, and you know, if we're just directionally correct on where NPL and capital levels are going, it's just tough to see the multiple getting that much worse. So this is the history. I'm not going to spend much time on it. It was, you know, they had a, it was nationalized. It came back, you know, to the public markets, you know, via an IPO. The important thing to note is what I'm going to talk about on the next couple of slides. In addition to having, you know, so 37% stake, if, you know, you screen banks as like tiny float, 75% of its own. So the actual tradable float is horribly small. 75% government owned, you know, could it get any worse? Well, yes. The NPL, so this is, you know, non-performing loans as percentage of total assets, 26%. It's a gargantuan number. And, you know, for, you know, if you're talking, you know, a number much above 2-4%, you know, people are like, we're in the middle of a horrible recession, and you think you're on the brink of a catastrophe here. Well, a lot of this is sort of the legacy issues, and some of this is just flat out accounting. What happened is anytime under the accounting standards that exist and with the Central Bank of Ireland rules, if any loan was modified, even if the borrower has been fully current on the modified loan for a period of time, it still shows up as an NPL. And this is a problem because you have the Irish banks sort of have two set of regulators. They have the ECB regulators, and then they have the Irish Central Bank. And the ECB says, look, you got to get all NPLs to south of 5% over the medium term. And the really only realistic way to do this is to, you know, do a block sale of a chunk of these loans. And the problem is with, you know, the Irish regulators sort of say, we don't want homeowners having to deal with private equity firms. And, you know, private equity moniker has not really taken off among the Irish politicians. They're simply known as vultures. And they say, you know, hey, we don't want anything to do with vultures. They've lost the Irish, government side. So there was two transactions that were announced. One is completed. One will be completed in the next month. And this takes a chunk of these non-performing loans and securitizes them off balance sheets. So this NPL ratio will be down to 10%, and we estimate it's going to rapidly fall throughout the rest of 2019 that will show. And so on a just screening basis, this is going to look like a substantially improved story. But the backside of this is also that it's not just the NPLs are coming down, the capital ratios are going up. And so here, essentially what we're going to talk about is when for bank purposes, are they adequately capitalized? It's a function of what is their capital level relative to risk-weighted assets. And sort of, you know, $1 of assets is the amount of capital you have to hold against it depends on what regulators deem to be more at risk. And so a higher risk weighting that you have, all else equal, you're going to have to hold more capital against this. And so their long-term target is 12%. And so they're above this now, and we think this number is rapidly going to increase. And so one thing to keep in mind is the risk weightings in Ireland. And part of this is understandable, given what the country went through during the housing crisis. But when we start talking about an Irish bank being overcapitalized, they are really overcapitalized because of the punitive risk weightings that they have for both residential and commercial loans. And keep in mind, these risk weightings are happening at the same time that the housing market is on fire. And so as you have a little bit of a cognitive dissonance is what I call it, because you have conflicting policy aims. You want to keep the banking sector very safe, understandably. But at the same time, a lot of people are getting priced out of the mortgage market, and the cost of an Irish mortgage is a lot more expensive than it is across the rest of the EU. And that's not isolated from these policies that force more capital to be held. So this is sort of the nitty gritty of the self-help story. And I'm going to go through this a little quickly and then can follow up with questions. But the NPLs, we talked about it. The big thing to keep in mind is this 25% stake right now, pro forma 10%. We show it's going to be somewhere around 6% by the end of the year. That's a very big move down. We think the allowance for loan loss is going to decline over time. And here's the progression of it. One thing to keep in mind is that the stage three, for those familiar with IFRS accounting, you know, stage three would be specific loan losses against individual credits. Stage two is a more generic, risk or allocation for potentially problematic assets, and it's directly tied to sort of stage three numbers. So if stage three allowance goes down over time, the stage two will as well. We don't show any benefit from that, but it's mechanical. And if we're right on this is the NPL progression over time, then the stage two allowance is also going to similarly decline. And so here we talked about the big performing Irish market, the housing market. You had a lot of loans that were maturing over the last couple of years. The stock loans would be the, you know, the loans, the floater, the tracking mortgages that were tied to ECB rates from legacy mortgage loans. You know, a lot of those have been rolling off, and it's prevented net loan growth despite the huge growth in new loans. In 2019, that should change. There's an offset a bit from some of those NPLs that come off the book were actually income producing. It sort of speaks to the quality of assets that were actually in that NPL category. So you do have a little bit of hit from that. But I think the net is you will continue to sort of be able to grow this. You'll be able to grow your performing loan book over time. And so this is, I think, really the key to the self-help story. And this is a lot of numbers that I highlight the two, big takeaway points. It's just the top part, think about it as the numerator. This is the risk-weighted asset progression. The bottom part's the denominator. It's the amount of capital against this. And these are the calculations for this. But so remember, we said, well, 12% is the target that they need. They're above this. We think the number is going to be somewhere between, probably call it the mid-15s to 16%. These aren't precise numbers, from the outside. I think we're directionally on the right idea, but, some of this is going to be inaccurate. But I think the key message is the difference between 15 and 12%, it's, this is half the market cap that could conceivably be returned as a dividend. And so it won't immediately. They'll need approval from the Irish Central Bank. They won't be able to do the lump sum at once. But order of magnitude, when you see NPLs coming down dramatically, capital ratios rising dramatically, a dividend beginning to be paid, and then talk about a large capital distribution, I think it's highly likely you've got a pretty good chance of a re-rating. And so naturally some would say, well, geez, how are you going to get the magical 10%, return on equity? You don't have enough scale, et cetera. I'm not going to argue that it's going to be a challenge absent a rise in interest rates for them to earn the 10% return. But again, if we're talking about like half the market cap is eligible for return, we have a lot of bumbling around financials in the United States that are, trading at meaningful premiums here. And, I don't know, the profile of the next couple of years on who has the higher ROE is maybe a little debatable. But obviously, there are a couple other ways to win. And this is the real bull scenario, a sale. And this is not just sort of theoretical. It's the ECB's supervisory arm had sort of said, geez, the Ulster Bank, which was part of the Royal, it's a subsidiary of the Royal Bank of Scotland, somewhat similar in size to Permanent TSB, saying you merge those two banks, you create a powerful number three. It could challenge the top two banks. And then, it's sort of in the various press release, Credit Suisse had sort of said, well, hey, if you do this, the synergies between the two banks are about 150 million euros. And I just sort of point out, I say, well, you can cut at least 20% of the operating expenses. Well, 150, that'd be half of the total operating expenses for TSB. Obviously, this is a home run. You have a risk with the government sort of saying, TSB and Ulster move, there's going to be bank, branch closings, there's going to be job losses. And I think that could be a factor in them deciding no, that they don't want to go through with this. But at the same time, a follow-on sale by the government would be very positive for the bank, less government ownership. But just if your only goal is you don't like banks, you're a politician in Ireland, you just say, I just want the taxpayer repaid, can't stand these banks, they hurt our entire country. It's still, it begs the question, okay, well, we can sell it right now at market, maybe at a discount to market, or we can get a return that could be 2x current levels or more from thinking about the possibility of a sale. So I think this is a real possibility. And then interest rates we talked about. So I would just sort of say, like, look, a 50 basis point increase, if we're sort of right on what the CET capital levels are, if they could operate at a 12% CET ratio with a 50 bip increase in interest rates, we're knocking on the door of coming close you know, to the magical, you know, 10%, you know, number in order to move closer to book value. Admittedly, you know, according to the forward curve, the odds of, you know, rate increase, you know, the length of time for a rate increase has probably gone down, has probably been pushed back a little bit over the last couple of months, given the volatility in the market. So, you know, here are the risks. I think obviously the big one is the 75% stake. There's a reason people, you know, would not want, you know, the government investing side by side. Economic rationalization may not be their absolute top priority. And so you have to weigh this risk, and clearly there's a deal that's screaming to happen that would create all sorts of value, but you have other considerations. So this is a clear risk. The Irish economy, the no deal Brexit is probably one near term that's hurting. The markets seem to think the no deal Brexit, the risk of this has increased. Most probably many would probably say it's not the most likely scenario. The Irish economy benefits from Brexit to a certain extent, but if this was ugly enough, could it just interrupt the 3 to 4% GDP type growth momentum and cause us all the way back to recession? The current valuation would suggest this is where we are. Obviously there's the difference in rates between Ireland and the rest of Europe. There's, you know, competition possibilities, but again, a new competitor still has to deal with those onerous, capital constraints and, you know, interest rates we talked about. You know, we're waiting for Godot and, hopefully he comes soon. So I'll stop there and then answer any questions, that you have.
Patrick, thank you so much for both of these very interesting ideas. Really appreciate the level of depth you have shared with us. I'd be curious if you could elaborate a little bit more on management at both companies, how you see the alignment and incentives, please.
Yeah, great. Jeffrey's pretty, easy. One to address, you know, straight off. Rich, Brian, they both own a ton of stock personally. The compensation proposals that they're compensated on, you know, have been, you know, rejiggered. They're, you know, now it's based upon a 3-year rolling total shareholder return and essentially a return on tangible equity. So the metrics by themselves are important. I think the comp scheme, it's an improvement. Is everything perfect? Maybe not, but whatever comp scheme you have for those guys, it's just the huge, they own a ton of stock, and that is gonna, they have a huge economic incentive to maximize the value of that while minimizing risk. And so I really think the alignment sets up very, very strongly for Jefferies. On the TSB side, so Jeremy Masding is the name of the CEO. This was a unglamorous job, to say the least. I mean, you're coming in, the government owns a stake. You've got sort of an angry group of politicians you're going to have to deal with. He spends part of his time being, if you just sort of Google permanent TSB plus congressional testimony, you can see sort of the fire he's put through on a regular basis. So the situation here is different. You know, they have specific rules saying you can't own, they restrict the amount of equity you can own. It's the incentive structure is not as strong on management ownership for sure. And he's very, very modestly paid relative to other, banking CEOs, as is the case for any bank where the government owns a stake in. So on appearance, it doesn't look like the incentives are as strongly aligned with Jeremy. I would say, though, that he has done it's been a plodding job, but he's been effective, and especially with these NPLs. And, you know, that is the part he could add the most value on, he's doing. And it's politically doing those two securitizations in the face of a bunch of, people saying, you're selling a bunch of stuff to vultures and having to endure that's where he could add the most value. The reality, unfortunately, is, you know, even if he was in favor of doing a deal with the Royal Bank of Scotland, in spending time talking with TSB, I get the impression that they would, you know, they think that'd be fantastic generator of returns. But ultimately, this is going to be a government call. And so there is a little bit of a uniqueness with this situation. I think where he can be most effective is the first part. He has done a great job of reducing the non-performers. The second part is going to be to get the capital allocation budget approved. And again, here we strangely have a fantastic alignment of interests. I think a big capital return would be looked favorably upon by shareholders. And obviously any dividend back to the government goes a long way to helping to, you know, repay for the recapitalization. Ultimately, the best alignment is going to be the government's desire to repay taxpayers, and they can better repay taxpayers by monetizing the stake at as high a price. And so that's sort of the reality of the TSB investment.
Great. Well, I'll leave it there, Patrick. I would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with you directly with their own thoughts or questions. We're happy to facilitate an introduction. Thanks once again for taking the time to be with us again and share your thesis with our community.
Great. Thanks a lot for your time.
Goodbye for now.